He remembered visiting him on his corner, the way he was with the children who approached him, drawing them in with his promise of shining train cars and paper birds. Even the ones who showed up with only a penny could buy a suite. It was a good time, and it lasted longer than Mary expected. One whole year, October 1904 to October 1905. And then, about the time the weather turned cold, he began arriving home in a quiet mood. He pushed his food around his plate. Where once he would say that it was a great life, he took to saying it was a good enough life for the time being. "Maybe you want your own store?" Mary suggested. It was not impossible. With a few more years of saving, the right rent, and the right location, maybe it could happen. 1905 had been a very good year for Mary. She'd worked continuously, and on her days off, she'd taken side jobs cooking for ladies' luncheons. But Alfred was shocked at the suggestion. "My own store? What I want is fewer toys in my life, Mary, not more. These kids..." He put his head in his hands. "You wouldn't believe the noise they make. I caught one putting a handful of sweets in his pocket without paying, and when I made him turn his pockets inside out, he said he had paid when I know very well he hadn't. I would have thrashed the kid if his father hadn't been standing right there grinning, probably telling the boy what to do. They're worse than the flies." He began sleeping late, opening his cart at noon, leaving at 2. On the same short block as Alfred's cart were 24 others, all packed in tightly against one another. Most were food peddlers, and Alfred claimed that under their carts was a year's worth of garbage. Mary didn't see why this was so upsetting to him all of a sudden, when it had been like that all along. Unlike other neighborhoods, where the garbage piles were removed regularly by the Department of Sanitation, the rubbish on the Lower East Side was packed 4 or 5 inches deep all along the block, and there was no skirting it. Each day's new garbage got trampled underfoot by the crowds, and when the city sweepers came with their wispy brooms on Tuesday mornings, it was like using a teaspoon to empty beaches of sand. "But it's getting to winter now. Winter always smells better than summer." Alfred could not be convinced. When the first snowfall came, he didn't bother going to his cart at all, and instead checked with the Department of Street Cleaning to see if they needed an extra man on their snow removal crew. The DSC took him on, gave him a crisp white uniform with matching hat, and out he went to pick up his cart, broom, and shovel with all the other white wings. Colonel Waring, New York City's latest street cleaning commissioner, referred to the white wings as his army, and Mary supposed it was an army of sorts, an army fighting against the enemy garbage, which was as powerful and intimidating as any foreign invader. But in February 1906, after a record-breaking snowfall, and after the DSC had to go upstate to Otisville to draft 75 additional men from the sanatorium to help clear the snow, they told Alfred to turn in his uniform. "What did you do?" Mary asked when she found out. It was a habit she couldn't seem to shake, asking questions she'd never get answers to. "They're desperate for men. They're advertising everywhere, and in the middle of that, they let you go?" When she could see he wasn't going to answer, she followed him down the stairs to the street, stuck to him as he rounded corner after corner, trying to shake her. Finally, he turned around. "Will you let it go, Mary?"
"No, I don't understand. You have to tell me. I don't know. It's not a real goddamn army, but they seem to think it is. It's freezing outside. Every man's gloves are soaked through by lunch, so I had to keep warm."
And Mary knew exactly what had happened. He'd gone to work with his flask, kept it in his pocket or his boot, and had sipped himself to warmth while he was working. And one day, he'd sipped too much. After that, he stopped trying to get work altogether, and instead went out early in the morning to sit in Nation's Pub all day long. Mary let it go for a few weeks, reminding herself that men were like cats that needed to lick their wounds for a good long time before going to battle again. And then she stopped, letting it go. When he got up and dressed, she asked him a dozen times where he was headed, and when he finally told her what she already knew, she couldn't stop herself from flying down the stairs of the building after him, telling him that he'd better wake up, pay attention. Life was not something to be frittered away on a bar stool, and if he wanted a woman who would mollycoddle such a man, he'd better look elsewhere. Alfred had always been a drinker, since the very first day. But he'd been a drinker like all men were drinkers, a constant, slow-paced drinker who walked the ledge easily, and in fact got through the day with more work behind him with the help of a little nip now and again. There was a time when no one could shovel coal like Alfred. No one could lead a pack of horses. No one could lift a piano. And what harm if during a job the men passed a flask and had a laugh and kept going, shoulder to the wheel? But what Alfred had done was work his way to the limit of the ledge to peek at what was below. He edged and edged, and finally, inevitably, he tumbled forward. The moments he came out of it were brief, and slipped by Mary like a breeze on a humid afternoon. One day, he was sound enough to fix the plaster by their window, and even repainted the whole wall. Another time, after Mary mentioned only once that they needed a new mattress, he went out and got one, and carried it up 6 flights on his back. He put it on the bed, made up the sheets, and carried the old mattress down to the curb before Mary came home. "Surprise," he said, after encouraging her to go lie down and rest after such a long day. She didn't check her emergency envelope in the closet. She didn't care. He'd heard her and acted, and she would not ask a single question and ruin it. Another time, after not coming home for 24 hours, he arrived, sober and shaven, and told Mary he was going to take her out for a steak dinner. They'd go to Dolan's, and after, they'd walk down to Germantown and go to a beer hall. Instead of asking him where he'd been, she suggested they skip Dolan's and bring their dinner with them to the beer hall so he'd have more time there, more time for him to speak German with his countrymen, and more time for Mary to listen to that choked language coming out of him. He never spoke German at home. He'd never taught her a single word. And sometimes she wondered if that was the key, if that was the thing that hung between them, and if she were only able to understand him in his first language, she'd be able to understand him completely, and they'd be happy, and everything would make sense. And then he disappeared again for a few days. Twice, Mary spotted him rounding corners in their neighborhood, and worse, heard him mentioned by the neighbors. "When I talked to Alfred yesterday," one or another of them would say, and Mary would not be able to hear the rest over the blood that rushed to her head. "I can't live like this," she said when he came home next, but he just smiled and hugged her and told her he missed her and pulled her toward him until they were both hip to hip. And how did he smell so clean when he'd been on a bender? Where did he go wash himself before coming home? More and more she found herself unable to get past that wall of questions. She couldn't kick sand over that inferno of fury that had started inside her with just one piece of kindling, and then grown with another, then another. When he pulled her toward their bed, she could no longer force her mind to think only of the warm cave of his body, even though she knew things were always better when she did put everything else aside and let him lift her and move her, let him be the Alfred she loved most. The 4th of July, 1906, saw good Alfred. Sober Alfred. He enlisted 2 other men on the block to go up to East Harlem with him, and together they bought 2 crates of fireworks and told as many as they ran into that they would be setting them off at midnight in the middle of 3rd Avenue. He referred to it as the annual tradition, though Mary could think of only one other time when he'd ever organized a fireworks show. Down on the street, when midnight came, he'd yelled at everyone to stay the hell back so that no one would get killed. Just as he was about to light the first match, he remembered the Borriellos and their 3 young boys and how they wouldn't want to miss it. "Run up, will you, Mary? See if they're awake." He was standing in the middle of the street with a match. Mary and everyone else knew the Borriellos would be awake because who in the city could sleep on such a night? It was the kind of summer night when even the thinnest cotton sheet felt as heavy and stifling as a rough wool blanket. People had taken their pillows to the roofs, to the fire escapes. It was the first unbearable night in a stretch that would last until August, and most of the men had come down in their undershirts. They were all sweating and panting and waiting for the sky to be illuminated. Mary ran up and pounded on the Borriello's door. "The boys," she said to Mrs. Borriello, who answered by cracking the door 1/2 inch. "Do they want to come down to the street to see? It'll just be a few minutes. I'll keep an eye on them." There was a pause, and Mary thought the door would be shut, but instead it opened wider, and 2 boys stumbled out and raced past Mary in their bare feet. The baby, the 3-year-old, struggled to keep up with his brothers. "They worry I'll change my mind," said Mrs. Borriello, smiling.
"And you? And Mr. Borriello?" Mary said. "Will you come down?"
"I'll watch from the window. My husband is on nights."
"Make sure you watch," Mary said as she turned and rushed after the boys.
"I'll bring him right up after."
More people had gathered by the time Mary returned to the street.
A ring of children formed an inside circle, closest to Alfred, and behind the children was a larger ring of adults. Mary recognized people she'd seen come and go at the Second Avenue grocer. She recognized a boy and his father from 28th Street. Alfred hollered at all of them to move back, farther, farther. And finally, when he felt everyone was far enough away, he crouched over the box of cylindrical packages, little circles and rockets with their fuses hanging out like tails, and made a selection. Before Mary could tell him to be careful, he'd struck the match against a stone and staggered backwards, holding up his arms as if the people who waited were a pack of animals who might stampede. "What happened?" the older Boriello boy said as the crowd watched the small flame travel up the fuse of the first rocket and then fizzled out. "A dud," another boy shouted. "Try another." Alfred selected another, but the same thing happened. A few of the men stepped forward to confer, and the crowd started getting restless, moving in different directions. "All right," Alfred called after a moment. "Problem solved." Again, he told everyone to move back. Again, he told everyone to beware, and on the third try, when he touched the match to the fuse, the little ball of fire ate the thin rope in an instant, and the rocket flew with a wild shriek into the sky, above the tenements of Third Avenue, arcing west for a moment before exploding red, white, and blue high over their heads, seeming to cover the whole island of Manhattan. The audience was transfixed, their faces lit, the kids open-mouthed, and for the next half hour, until the very last sparkler had died, Mary was proud of him, that he'd done this for all of them, and she remembered why she loved him. He was good for 3 weeks after that. He wasn't working, but he stayed away from the bars and sometimes made supper and bought the newspaper for Mary and went for long walks. When the message came that she had to go to Oyster Bay sooner than planned because the regular cook's grandchild had come early, he acted as if she were lying, as if she made it up to get away from him. So he disappeared, and when he finally came home just in time to say goodbye, she slipped past him and down to the street. She didn't want to look at him. She didn't want to hear herself say all the things she knew she'd have to say. The remainder of his toy stock, a set of 2 play cups and saucers for girls, a china cat with 1 blue eye and 1 brown, marbles, a checker set, nearly a dozen toy soldiers without the faces painted on. All of it had been sitting in a box in the corner of their bedroom for the past 6 months. Before leaving for Oyster Bay, Mary left the whole crate outside the door of the Boriello family. Looking back from the quiet of North Brother, her bare feet covered in wet sand and with an egret for company, the water lapping at the fallen hem of her skirt, it all seemed like a very long time ago, far longer than just a couple of years. Fighting with Alfred, that hot spring and summer of 1906, up and down the stairs of their building with sweat running in streams between her breasts, it all seemed like a fever that had now broken, and like so many of the patients she'd nursed, now she was on the other side, amazed that her skin was cool to the touch, bewildered by the stark blankness of everything without that heat to color it, without those swings from joy to rage. At the center of everything, like a selection of notes played at a lower register while the rest of the song sways and dives around it, was the fact that she loved him. She'd loved him since she was 17, and even when she wanted to take her skillet and swing it at him, even that time when she did take her skillet and swing it at him, she loved him. Everything would be easier if she didn't. On the evening before Alfred's visit, Mary dragged the tub from a cobwebbed corner of her hut and out to the middle of the room. She ran a damp cloth along the inside to pick up any dust, and then she poured in kettle after kettle of boiling water until it was halfway full. She usually went up to the hospital when she wanted a bath. They had tubs there with running hot and cold water. But she didn't want to be seen or questioned or rushed. She readied her soap, her tooth powder, her washcloth, her shampoo, and when she stepped in and lowered herself, the water rushed for the edges and sloshed over the brim. It ran in streams toward the door. Mary washed. She pinched her nose and dipped her head under the surface, and then rubbed the shampoo into her scalp with her fingertips. She dunked again to rinse. She soaped her neck, her long arms, her legs by lifting one out above the water in a straight line and then the other. She stood up quickly and soaped her breasts, her belly, her hips, between her legs, and plunged back into the exquisite warmth of the water, and wondered why she didn't perform the same ritual more often. She soaked, and thought about what attitude she should take when she greeted him. It was unforgivable how little he'd been in touch. If it were Alfred, who'd been locked up, she would have sent him the things he missed the most. She would have tried to see him, even if they told her there were no visitors allowed. But it wasn't Alfred who'd been taken away, and what was the point of saying how she would have been, and how he should have been, and marching out the long list of grievances when he was coming, finally, tomorrow? Maybe he was turning over a new leaf. Aunt Kate, before she died, said he was a rogue, but the charmingest, handsomest rogue she'd ever seen in her life, and Mary knew she liked him, because whenever he stopped up for her, Aunt Kate made him sit into a plate of stew, and, if they had it, a dram of whiskey. Later, Aunt Kate would go around her rooms, pointing out pieces Mary could have when she married. Her mantel clock, her lace-fringed pillows. "And if I'm gone," she said, "I've written it all down for Patty. On Mary's wedding day, I wrote and a list of things to be yours." Mary pulled a clean dressing gown over her head, removed a mason jar from the shelf, and emptied the tub, jar by jar, until it was light enough to push to the door where she tipped it. She listened to the water rush down the single stair, onto the grass, into John Kane's pansies and snapdragons. He would not have to water in the morning. She went about brushing and separating her hair. She had no curlers, so she twisted each section around her finger and then pinned it against her scalp. She had only a dozen pins, and her hair was thick and long, so twice she'd run out and had to start over again with a better sense of proportion. He would probably notice right away the pains she'd taken. He knew her well enough now to know she didn't wake up with curls. Or maybe he'd never noticed. She counted the years since they met. Almost 25. 2 years fewer than she'd been in America. She was employed by the Mott family the first time she saw him, and even though she was washwoman, she also worked a little in the scullery as assistant to the cook. It was the agreement they'd come to at the office. If she was ever to be hired as head cook, she had to have experience. She'd left her work trimming beans when she heard the bell ring. Where was the maid? She wiped her hands, and as she came down the hall, she could make out the outline of a man's arm and hip in the thin strip of glass inlaid in the thick oak. Other than the bell, the house was completely silent. There were no guests expected that day. "I brought the coal," the man said when she opened the door. His barrel sat on the step beside him, and his clothes were covered in coal dust. He had a smudge on his forehead that blended with his coal-black hair. "This is the front door," she said to him in a fierce whisper, quickly stepping outside and shutting the door behind her. "Do you deliver through the front door at other homes?" She glanced back to peer through the strip of glass to see if anyone was coming.
"I usually deliver to businesses," he said. "I'm covering."
He didn't seem to notice Mary's response and made no move to lift his barrel and move along. He crossed his arms and leaned against the iron banister that led up the 3 wide steps to the door.
"So what are you then, nanny?"
"No," Mary said. He had high cheekbones that reminded her of a wolf. He also had a masculine jaw, a throat flecked with black stubble. On the first floor of Aunt Kate's building lived a 16-year-old boy who always seemed to be hopping a ball on the street when Mary entered or exited the building, and once in a while he came up to knock on their door. Mary had no more interest in him than she did in any other boy in Hell's Kitchen. He was someone to talk to when there was nothing to do, but when he tried to kiss her inside the first floor vestibule, Mary had dodged him and then laughed. Now he hopped his ball outside another building.
"Washwoman?"
Mary nodded and clutched her hands behind her back. He seemed to Mary to be at least 25, and as they each waited for the other to speak, she noticed the gentle flutter at his neck. "Alfred," he said, extending his hand. Mary shook it quickly and then looked at the black dust he'd left behind on it.
"And you're Mary?"
"How did you know?"
"All the Irish girls are named Mary. Every single one, swear to God."
"Ah," Mary said, her glance falling again on the flutter at his neck. She wanted to put her thumb there, feel the beating of his blood. The horse he'd left on the street seemed an angry animal. He was pitching forward and back, stamping with impatience, and the hill of coal in the cart was sliding, a few hard lumps hitting the road. Perhaps the horse knew its master had knocked on the wrong door. It was March. Late in the winter for a delivery of coal, but the family had almost run out and feared the cold nights that late March and even April might bring.
"Aren't you going to tell me not to swear to God?"
"What?" Mary said, and felt as if she had to shake herself awake.
"What are you?"
She thought she detected an accent in certain words, but she couldn't pin it down.
"All American,"
he said, and opened his arms wide. Every time he moved, a fine layer of black dust drifted down to the step where they were standing. He lowered his arms. German, but I've been here since I was 6. And how old are you now?
You ask a lot of questions,
he seemed amused. 22.
You?
17.
He looked at Mary that day. Bright, green eyes rimmed with lashes as black as the coal in his bin, and for a few seconds, Mary no longer cared if someone came up the hall and spotted them through the glass. His work shirt was unbuttoned at the very top, and underneath, the neck of his undershirt had gone black with soot. When he took off his clothes at the end of the day, there would be parts of him that could not be scrubbed clean, and other parts that were pure white.
"Which door is it, then?"
Mary pointed to the servant's entrance, which also served for house deliveries, especially deliveries of dirty things, like coal, or things that might drip, or have an odor, or, in general, any type of thing that the family would prefer not to know about. Just inside the servant's door was the chute, where any coal man would know to send the black stones down to the cellar. They like to know their beds are warm, their underwear clean, but they don't like to know how it gets that way.
Alfred raised an eyebrow. That's cheeky.
Mary didn't know why she'd said it out loud, but now that she had, she couldn't disown it. She hadn't expected a reprimand, especially not from a man who'd left a trail of coal that someone else would have to sweep away. Not even sweep, Mary corrected herself, remembering how coal dust smeared and spread further when wiped. She'd probably have to fill a bucket and drag it out there to splash the dust away. The work that would be, and in this cold. Mary was tired of having wet, cold hands in wet, cold weather.
It was cheeky of you to ring the bell, Mary said. Use your head. Does any family take a coal delivery through the front door?
Alfred shrugged, but Mary noticed the skin around his collar become mottled.
I told you I'm covering.
Mary leaned over the rail and again pointed out the lower door, almost around the side of the house, but not quite. As she leaned, he also leaned, to see what she was seeing, and Mary felt the rough cloth of his work shirt against the thin cotton at her back. She sensed the body within, solid and strong. "There," she said, and when she looked back at him over her shoulder, he wasn't looking toward the door at all. Mary worried about the lamb's blood she'd wiped on her apron, about Mr. Mott's 12 dress shirts that had to be soaked, rinsed, dried, pressed, and hung, and about him, this grown man, who even on a cold, wet day seemed to give off warmth like a flagstone in summer, long after the sun goes down. Still, with that half-smile, he took both handles of the coal bin, heaved it up with a forward thrust of the hips, and made his way to the far door.
"I'll see you, miss," he said.
Inside, with the doors closed tight, Mary listened to hard knots of anthracite slide along the metal throat of the chute, the crunch of his large tin scoop driven into the pile again and again. Saturday morning was overcast, and the skies threatened to storm. When she woke and smelled rain in the air, she told herself not to be disappointed if he didn't come. The ferries wouldn't run if the waters were too rough, and it wouldn't be his fault. But when she went outside to see if she could spot the dock through the fog, everything seemed to be running as usual. John Kane stepped out of the mist and onto the path just before Mary, with a covered plate in his hand.
"Everything all right?"
he inquired, peering at her unusual hairstyle.
"Fine."
She took the plate, peeked under the lid, and sighed. After 2.5 years, she was getting to the point where she would mug someone for a good plate of eggs and rashers.
"Are the ferries operating on time?"
"They are," John said, putting one foot. "Why, expecting someone? That lawyer?"
"You are the nosiest person I ever knew in my life."
"Your man?"
"I don't put it that way, but yes."
"What kind of name is Alfred, anyway? What's his surname?"
"Brayhoff. It's German."
"What part of Germany?"
"John, do you have any work to do today? Are you paid to work or just to visit?"
"I just like to know things, is all."
"Doesn't everyone? But not everyone thinks it's right to ask."
"Not everyone, that's true. Take you, for example. You've hardly asked me a single thing."
"Okay. Tell me something about yourself."
But John just shrugged and walked back up to the hospital. Mary saw him before the ferry docked. She saw his dark head swaying with the rhythm of the water. She watched him leap from the boat to the pier without the assistance of the handrail. She watched him say something to the ferry's captain, and then both men wheeled around to face Mary's bungalow. She lifted her arm and waved. They walked toward each other. He leaned in to kiss her when they met on the path, but she told him to wait. Not yet. She'd say when. He looked so good and so young and so healthy. His teeth were clean and white. His neck was shaved close without a single nick. He was tall. He moved with the ease of a man who was well-fed and well-washed and had full use of his lungs and got physical exercise every day. So this is how she appeared to the patients of the hospital. This was the light they were looking at when they sat, wrapped in blankets and propped up on hospital benches and stared at her, struggling to recall what being fully alive was like. Mary and Alfred, they weren't as young as they once were, but they weren't so bad. Not so bad at all. She pointed out the hospital building, the chapel, the coal house, the male dormitory, the morgue, the nurses' quarters, the physicians' quarters, the lighthouse, the female dormitory, the stable, the sheds, and her own little shack, which she promised to show him later. She led him down the path that John Kane had cleared for her, down to the beach and her snowy egret. They found a damp log to sit on, and she pointed out the Bronx to their left, and to the right, South Brother and Rikers. To their far right was Astoria, and behind them, of course, was Manhattan. She asked him if North Brother was as he had pictured it. "No," he said. "There's more here than I thought. It's like its own little village, and yet..." "What?" "It's still empty. Where is everyone?" "Their patients. Most of them will die here, or they work here and they go home at night." Mary waited for him to kiss her again, but the moment seemed to have passed. He seemed darker now, caught up in thoughts of his own, and she worried that he regretted coming, that he'd come up with an excuse to leave. "How are things at the ice company?" He didn't seem to hear her. "What's to stop you from getting on the ferry one day and going over, disappearing? Couldn't you work under another name?" "Oh, the guards, for a start. The ferry captain. It's always the same man and he knows me." "You could hide. You could wait for a moment when he's not looking and then hide on the boat, under the bench, and then sneak off on the other end when he's occupied with something." "You saw the size of the boat? And they run it only if there's people to take it. Do you think it would work?" Alfred was silent, brooding over something. "Besides, I don't want to work under another name. I haven't done a thing wrong. I should be allowed to work under my own name. Mr. O'Neill says he's making progress, and, Mary, there are men who've done the same as I'm accused of, and they're walking free. I have to tell you something." Alfred walked to the water's edge, picked up a stone, and threw it. So this was it, Mary thought. This, whatever this was. This was the thing that had driven him uptown and across Hellgate to see her. He kept his back to her, and she remained silent. She would not make it easier by drawing it out of him. "I wanted to tell you when you were kept at that hotel, but then they wouldn't let me see you, and I didn't want to tell you during the hearing because I was afraid you'd make a scene and hurt your case. So this is better, really, this way, alone here. I think it's best anyway." "Why would I make a scene?" Whatever it was, she would not make a scene in this spot, the only peaceful place she'd discovered on the entire island. "You've been gone for more than 2 years now." Mary put her hands to her head and her chin to her knees. She knew it. She damned well knew it. She knew it, and she didn't know she knew it. "And most of the papers say they're never letting you off this island." Mary stood up from the log, brushed off the back of her skirt, and headed up the path. He took a few quick steps after her and caught her arm. "Like I told you, I couldn't afford the 33rd Street room, so I took a bed at the Meanies." "Oh, yes. The Happy Meanies and their son, Samuel, for whom you like to set a good example." "For whom Mrs. Meany forced me to set a good example. After a week there, she said I could stay on only if I stopped drinking." "And yet you're still there?" "I did the Oppenheimer treatment. I'm still doing it. Her husband did it, and it worked for him, and she thought it might work for me." "It's bogus. Everyone knows it's bogus. They take your money and you drink the quinine until you're so sick you can't take a sip of anything. And then the cure is telling you not to drink. Then the day you stop the quinine, it doesn't work anymore. The husband is still not drinking?" "The husband is dead." Mary squatted on the path, touched her fingertips to the ground to steady herself. That was it. She almost smiled. She'd felt it between them when she saw him in New York, but she couldn't put a name on it. Now she could. Alfred remained standing. "How long dead?" "About 5 years now."
Mary felt her stomach lurch.
You said the Meanies might let me stay with you there until we found our own place. You said you'd ask. When you spoke of them, you said they and implied a Mr. and a Mrs.
I did.
Why?
I... Alfred leaned against a tree.
I just thought I'd explain it all later, away from all those people. Or I thought maybe I'd leave the Meanies that afternoon once you got free and we'd get our own place again. I hadn't decided. I was still deciding. Liza is not as strong as you are. I'd have to be very careful about it.
And now you've decided.
I wasn't given a choice. Those judges decided. What am I to do, Mary? Live like a monk for the rest of my life? You know I love you, and as God is my witness, to this day I've never met anyone like you. But I thought there were things we understood about each other. And there's the boy. He's a good boy. A smart boy. He...
Mary held up her hand.
I don't care one fiddle about that boy or about delicate Liza.
She itched to slap him, but it would hurt him more if she didn't care. She felt her lungs heaving, her blood moving just under the surface of her skin, but instead of taking a stick and beating him, instead of unleashing the long string of words that had lined up, she simply walked away. At the top of the path, at the point where John had to get on his knees with his scythe and clear the brambles and thorns, she turned around.
I have only one question, and I want you to tell me the truth.
She would not cry. She would not let her voice waver.
I begged you to stop drinking. I hauled you up all those stairs. I gave you money when you couldn't work. I shaved you. I cut your hair. Do you know how good things would have been if you hadn't been drinking? Remember how good those stretches were when you didn't drink? Do you remember?
I remember. Of course I remember. He stepped toward her and she stepped back.
So why? When Liza Meany asked, did you march yourself straight to the doctor's office for the Oppenheimer cure?
Mary felt the pin curls loosen from the bun where she'd gathered them. She felt how lank and pathetic each tendril was that hung about her face.
I don't know. I do know that I love you, Mary, as much as always, and I could never love her like I love you.
You can love her as much as you like, Alfred.
Wait.
Alfred grabbed her elbow and she spun, turned on him, ready to fight if he came any closer.
There's one more thing.
What's that?
And just know before I tell you that it's because of the boy. He's still young and it's only...
Mary laughed. She tipped her head back and laughed. She laughed at the birds, at the top of the trees, at the waves, at the furious, roiling Hellgate, at the sound of the foghorn in the distance, at the thought of John Kane hurrying with her plate, at the doctors, at the nurses, at their needles, their test tubes, their glass collection canisters. She laughed at her own stupidity and the stupidity of all the fools working and living and breathing over in Manhattan. She laughed at herself for ever having been sorry to have left it.
You've asked her to marry you.
And she's said yes.
After he left, after she watched the ferry pull away from the dock and churn west, Mary went back to her spot by the water. Her snowy egret had not shown itself while Alfred was there and stayed hidden now. She hugged her knees, feeling the hollow place that laugh had bubbled forth from earlier. If there was something funny in what he'd told her, she could no longer see it. After a while, she realized it was getting dark and it had started to rain again. The loose sand that met with the tree line was pressed down by the drops, and then it was pouring. The drops hitting the river so hard that the surface of the water jumped and frothed, and she hoped, if his ferry had not reached the other side yet, that it would fill up with this angry weather and sink. And then she hoped it wouldn't. Late, long after the supper hour, long after the island had gone dark, she saw electric torches approaching from the small, wooded divide that separated her from the hospital. She heard voices on John's path. Two nurses approached her and put their umbrellas together to cover her as they walked her back.
"What are you thinking, Mary?" the one asked. "What are you doing?"
The other said, "You'll make yourself sick."
13.
"How are you doing, Mary?"
Mr. O'Neill asked.
It was the fourth day of February 1910. Their second face-to-face meeting since the disappointment of the hearing the previous summer. It was unseasonably warm, and instead of meeting in Mary's bungalow or in one of the meeting rooms of the hospital, Mr. O'Neill suggested they sit at one of the new picnic tables at the tuberculosis pavilion and take in the fresh air. So far, Mary had not seen anyone else use the new tables and said so to Mr. O'Neill. "Even better," he said. "We'll be the first." He wanted her to be outside when he told her the news. He wanted her to be able to whoop and shout and dance. He wanted her to be able to celebrate in full view of all those hospital windows looking down on them from above, all those eyes behind the windows, observing, trying to guess what was going on. Hers was the longest case he'd ever worked on, and at home, over the weekend, his wife had already invited their friends to open bottles of champagne and toast him. Of all the women he'd ever encountered in his life, Frances O'Neill decided that Mary Mallon was the hardest to read. Last time he'd come to see her, just before Christmas, he'd told her that there was hope for her case, more hope than ever before. A new health commissioner was to be installed early in 1910, and he'd already gone on record with his sympathy for Mary's plight. "It's likely he'll release you once he takes office," Mr. O'Neill told Mary. He imagined this would be a Christmas gift to her, a baton of hope that she could carry through the holidays, but the news didn't seem to register at all. A few of the doctors at the hospital mentioned that she seemed to have mellowed since the summer. Where she'd always seemed to take great pains to appear neat and presentable, to tell Mr. O'Neill her opinion on all matters related to her case or not, she now seemed subdued, worn down. Her hair was unclean and falling out of her bun. Her collar drooped. Her lips were so chapped that he could see where they had cracked and bled and dried and broken open again. "I guess we'll see," was all Mary said then, and instead seemed more interested in the food he'd brought for her, all wrapped in parcel packages like Christmas presents, smoked ham, cheese, candied walnuts, chocolate-covered cherries, Christmas cookies. She opened the walnuts for them to share during that meeting, but he didn't want to put his fingers in the box where her fingers had been, so he told her that walnuts didn't agree with his stomach. "Shall I open the cherries?" But he said no, he'd eaten just before leaving the city, and she leveled a look at him as if to say she'd heard that one before. Back then, he'd attributed her mood to the general lowness some people feel around Christmas, and reminded himself that it was hard enough to be alone at the holidays, and even harder for her. But now, on a fine February day with every promise of spring in the air, he'd come to see her with more news, and she didn't seem any more interested than before. "Health Commissioner Ladarrell has been installed," he said once they were seated.
"Who?"
"The new commissioner I mentioned when we last met."
"Yes, yes, of course."
"And one of the things we've been talking about, not just he and I, but many medical people, is how many carriers there are, Mary. It's become clear now that there must be hundreds of them, thousands. Your case is not so special after all, and that's a good thing."
Mary frowned and picked at a splinter of wood in the tabletop.
"Mary?" He waited until she looked at him. "He's decided to release you. The paperwork has already gone through. You'll be off this island and back home by the end of the week."
He brought her a present to go with the news. It was his wife's idea, and when he agreed, she'd gone straight out to get from Mary, whom she'd never met, something colorful and beautiful, something any woman would be proud to wear. "Men don't understand about having nice things to wear," she said, and he told her to go to the same shops she visited, spend the same as she would spend on herself. He took it out now and pushed it across the table toward her. She laid the package on her lap, but only played with the string.
"What do you mean about my case not being so special? That means they still believe I gave the fever to all those people?"
"Well, yes."
They'd been on this case together long enough to be frank. She was every bit as intelligent as she insisted she was.
"It's true, you know," he said. "You are a carrier. It's difficult to accept, but you must have had time to think about it over these 3 years. The point is that it's not your fault."
"But I cooked for so many people who never got sick. I cooked for hundreds of people over the years, and only 23. I don't..." "That's part of it, too, the way it comes and goes. And some people are immune. That's one of the reasons they've kept you here, to study your patterns, but it's not your responsibility to provide them with the data they need, and Ladurl agrees. They can't lock up everyone who carries the fever.
The best alternative right now is to let you go on the condition that you will never cook for hire again. You're no harm to anyone unless you're cooking.
Mary sighed. Of course. It was what he'd been urging her to volunteer since the very beginning, to quit cooking, to give up one life and sign on for another. The commissioner has objected to your confinement since day one, and through his own contacts, he's already gotten you work at a laundry. It's on Washington Place, right by the park.
Mary did a few quick calculations in her head. She'd have to stay in a boarding house at first, and then she'd have to get a room to share. A laundry? A laundress? Time was moving backwards.
And you'll have to check in with the Department of Health every 3 months, so they can keep track of you, take your samples and all that. You're not the only one. You're doing that with all the carriers they know about, so they can more easily locate the source of an outbreak if one occurs.
For how long? The checking in, I mean?
For the rest of your life, Mr. O'Neill said. Or until they find a cure. Or until vaccination becomes routine.
For the rest of my life? Mary repeated. What if I move?
You'll have to let the DOH know, and then you'll register wherever you end up.
Are you thinking of leaving New York?
No.
She wasn't, and didn't even know why she'd asked.
What about Soper? Will I have to see him again?
No, Mr. O'Neill said.
He leaned closer to Mary, as if they were old friends catching up. I hear he's trying to peddle a memoir and is having no luck.
Mr. O'Neill's smile disappeared when he saw Mary's face. Mary hated that man more than she hated any person she'd ever known in her life.
Just open the present, Mary. He tapped the box.
She untied the ribbon, folded back the tissue paper, and discovered the most beautiful emerald green shawl she'd ever seen. Along the edges were birds stitched in royal blue. She wrapped it around her shoulders and pictured how it must look against the red in her hair. She remembered her beloved blue hat with the silk flowers. Where had it ended up? She imagined it hanging in George Soper's office, a memento of his life's work.
Mr. O'Neill waited for her to speak, and she knew he wanted her to say more, to jump up and down and be happy. But she couldn't speak because she didn't trust her tongue to contain its acid. And it was not his fault if he didn't understand the difference between a cook and a laundress. She'd make a third of what she was making before, probably less. Her knuckles would itch and crack and bleed and cramp, and when she became an old woman, her hands wouldn't work at all anymore, and she'd have to get neighbors to come upstairs and open jars, twist doorknobs. It would be like Mr. O'Neill having to leave his position as attorney and go work instead as the bicycle messenger who brought paperwork back and forth between the law offices and the courthouse all day. But she closed her eyes and took a breath and decided to sweep away every disappointment, to look instead at what he was offering. She remembered how scared she'd been in Queenstown, waiting for that ship to lower its gangway, and again in Castle Garden, where no one understood her brogue, and a stranger had hooked her by the eyelid and peered at her like he would an interesting fish. She'd been scared when she met Alfred, and again when Aunt Kate died. She'd been scared before, she'd be scared again. She'd be fine.
Thank you, she said. It's really lovely. Tell your wife thank you, too.
I will.
The next morning, she opened the door of her hut to find her newspaper had been opened and refolded so that an article from the city section was on top. Typhoid Mary to be released by week's end, the headline read.
Typhoid Mary, she whispered as she reached for the paper. Unlike the other names they'd given her, most often the germ woman, a title that seemed and felt anonymous, something she could easily disown. Typhoid Mary had a ring to it, and as she studied the bold-faced type of the paper in her hand, she felt it settle on her. She felt it stick.
Word spread quickly around the island. The nurses came in pairs and groups of three to say goodbye. Maybe they had more sympathy than she'd credited, Mary considered as they bade her best wishes and good luck. Maybe she'd been kinder than she thought. Even Dr. Albertson made his way down the path one afternoon. Good luck to you, Mary, he said, and continued on his way for a walk. John Kane avoided her. One morning, when it snowed, he cleared her step while she was in the hospital signing forms, and she could see by the footprints he left that he was avoiding the path. John, she called to him another morning. She was walking from the lighthouse, and he was over by the nurse's dormitory, shaking salt on the narrow road.
But he didn't hear her, or wouldn't listen, and by the time she arrived at the place where he'd been standing, he was nowhere in sight. Finally, on Thursday afternoon, she caught him walking near her door. "John!" she called out from her step. She waved him over. He seemed to hesitate, but then turned onto the path that led to her hut. "Are you avoiding me?" she asked, smiling, hoping to disarm him. She didn't want to leave him angry with her, and she didn't want to leave without him accepting that he had no reason to be angry.
"Nope." "Do you know I'm leaving tomorrow?"
"I heard something about that."
"Well, aren't you going to say goodbye?"
"I was going to wait." He stamped his boots and left treads of snow outside her door. "You still have another day. Don't get ahead of yourself."
"John."
"Besides, it's like you said. Those people are tricky, and they might change their minds at the last minute. And then won't we all feel a bit silly for having said goodbye?"
"John."
"Besides, it's like you said. Those people are tricky, and they might change their minds at the last minute. And then won't we all feel a bit silly for having said goodbye?"
"They won't change their minds. It's all signed and sealed. I have a job waiting for me."
"Well, good. That's good." Mary understood what was eating him, but there was no possible way to say it. After he'd pinned her for not asking him any personal questions, she'd made sure to pose a few, now and again, in light conversation. And over the months, she'd learned that he had no wife, no children, and lived on East 98th Street with his younger brother, who was bigger and stronger than John, but who was not right in his mind and could not hold a job because he was prone to fits so violent that he'd once bitten clear through his own tongue. This brother tried to care for John like a wife, doing the cleaning and shopping, the cooking, but he was not a wife. Not nearly a wife. And Mary also understood, without ever needing to ask the question, that what John wanted his whole life long was a real wife. And he had not given up.
"I want to tell you something," John said, and Mary cursed herself for letting it come to this. "I want to tell you that I don't think things are so bad here on North Brother. I think it's a pretty spot, and your bungalow is sound, if a little on the damp side, but show me a building that isn't. And I think you have to admit you've had pretty good company when you've sought it. You've had someone to talk to, is what I mean. Would you agree?"
"I agree completely."
"But you still want to leave?"
"Yes."
"Well, then I want to tell you something else. That Alfred who came here that time, your man. Yes, I know you said he's not your man anymore, and yes, I know you didn't put it like that, but I can put two and two together, and what I want to say is that Alfred is not a good character. I don't mean because of what the papers said about the way you lived or any of that. I just mean, man to man, I can tell a good one from a bad one, and I don't trust that one to stay away from you once you're over there again. Remember I said that, and remember that he didn't have the patience to wait for you while you were here, like any other man would. Like a few other men I can think of would have done without a doubt. And now look where his impatience got him. Don't forget that, Mary, once he comes around."
"I won't forget," Mary promised. And all the humor she'd felt a moment earlier, all the warmth toward her friend, disappeared, and instead she felt her stomach tighten, her head fill up with electric sparks.
"Well, I had to say it," John said, and now his burden lifted. He seemed like the old John, at home with himself and with the door frame of Mary's bungalow. "And maybe we can visit sometime over there. I can tell you the news of North Brother. We can go for a walk or something."
"John," she stepped forward and hugged him, and felt where the top of his head met with her ear. She couldn't help it. She felt it was like hugging a child. A solid, muscular child, but still a child. A child's narrow shoulders. A child's way of clinging to her when he wants comfort, and she couldn't muster up a single morsel of attraction toward him.
"Let's do that."
14. When Mary was 17, but passing herself off as 25 or 26, turning from the sidewalk and pushing the heavy wrought iron gate that led to the front door of a house like the Warrens had rented in Oyster Bay or the Bowens had on Park Avenue, would have made her body a hard knot of dread. It was worse when the woman of the house was young, newly married, maybe only 18 or 20 herself. Girls of 20 know by instinct who is at least their own age and who is younger, and Mary would compensate by marching into the kitchen with authority, maybe even a little disdain. She'd thicken her accent like a gravy on the stove and hope that would explain to them why she seemed so young. A cultural difference, Mary could see the young mistress thinking. This is the way the Irish are, I suppose. Once, when she arrived to cook for the Hill family on Riverside Drive, the mistress had taken one look at her and told her outright that she didn't believe Mary's age or experience. Mary had just turned 18 and had slowly been getting jobs the agency didn't know about. Aunt Kate would hear about something from a friend, or Mary would answer an ad in the newspaper. In addition to a home so large that it could have housed a dozen families, the Hills had 3 carriages, 6 horses, and a pair of Shetland ponies for the children, who were not yet old enough to ride them. Mrs. Hill told Mary to be on her way. "I only look young," Mary insisted, feeling as she said it exactly what she was, a skinny child who hadn't eaten a proper meal since her last employment. "You'll get no one else out here today. I might as well make dinner before I go." Mrs. Hill hesitated. "I am hungry," she admitted and patted her considerable belly. "Only porridge this morning." After showing Mary to the kitchen, Mrs. Hill left her alone to create something wonderful out of the bland bits and pieces that had been left behind by the previous cook and the pale chicken carcass the porter had been sent out to fetch that morning. Mary found flour, butter, eggs, raisins, rosemary, 3 old apples she knocked on and then tested for juice with her front teeth. An hour later, she brought Mr. and Mrs. Hill, along with their 2 children, plates of walnut and raisin chicken salad, with fresh bread and baked apples on the side. She stayed at the Hills until her true age was exposed by a porter who'd overlapped with her at a job in Brooklyn Heights. For the next few months, Mary had to go back to washing and ironing, giving her the feeling that life was just one long, narrow road, with no turns, no peaks or valleys. "I can't take it," she used to say to Aunt Kate when she'd go home. "You'll take it," Aunt Kate assured her. "You'll take it like everyone else." She'd been repeating the words to herself since stepping onto the ferry. "You are no longer a cook. You're a laundress. You sign the papers. Better to be a laundress in New York City than a cook trapped in a bungalow on an island of death." The boarding house where she'd slept since Friday night served decent enough food, to Mary's surprise, but she didn't like the company. Men slept on a different floor than the women, but they all took their meals together, and there was too much eyeing and gawking for Mary to be able to enjoy her plate. To the one wall-eyed man who kept breathing in her direction and then whispered that he liked the look of her, she stated plainly that she'd make him sorry if he ever came near her. He'd laughed, the food he'd just eaten a pulp on his exposed tongue, but she stared at him without changing her expression. He snapped his mouth closed and turned back to his beef and barley. When Mary walked into the laundry on that Monday morning in February 1910, she felt flat, tired, and hungry, as if all those years between hurrying after Patty Brown in Castle Garden and that moment, pushing open the door to a Chinese laundry, were no more than a matter of weeks, and she was no older now than she'd been then. The laundry was on Washington Place and Green Street, directly next to the taller Ash Building, and on Mary's first day, the entrance was blocked by a lake of icy slush so deep she had to hitch up her skirt to stride through it. It was a busy street, full of students from New York University and women working at the factories up and down the block. The laundry was open to customers every day except for Sundays, and the washers, too, had the day off. But those who ironed and hung had to show up for at least 4 or 5 hours on Sundays in order to press and fold or hang what had been washed the day before. It was a small operation, a front room to welcome customers, a middle room where Chu, the owner, slept, and a back room where all the washing and pressing took place alongside a little kitchen and sitting area that they were allowed to use for 30 minutes out of every day. Chu did not speak to Mary, but directed all his instructions to another Chinese man named Li, and Li translated all Chu's instructions for Mary. "Here is where you stand," he told her. "Here is how you ring. Here is how you shake out, how you hang, how you feel for dampness. In certain fabrics, it was preferable to iron before completely dry. In others, the garment must absolutely be bone dry before touching with a hot iron, or else the iron would stick and the garment would burn, and Mary would be out of a day's wages. The irons must be kept hot, but not so hot that they would scorch, and they must be kept clean. Mary would find, Lee warned, that by the end of the day, the irons would feel heavier, and Mary would be slower to move them, and so she should be on guard for this always. Everyone was to take turns up front if Chu was not available, or if he couldn't make himself understood, or if the customer did not want to speak to a Chinese. Lee gave her the main instructions for handling the customers. No one, under any circumstances, could pick up laundry without a ticket unless Chu gave his explicit permission. Mary should not be surprised if people came in asking for clothes that had never existed and then demanding compensation for those imaginary clothes. She must never concede. If she thought she was being swindled, she should stop and get help. Keep the cash drawer locked. And finally, because Mary spoke English, she'd be asked to serve as interpreter from time to time. "But you speak English," she said, interrupting him. "You are white. They won't try so many tricks with you. My father was born here, and me as well, but I still have a Chinese face." "But not as Chinese as Chu," Mary said, before she'd stopped to think that maybe it wasn't a good idea to have him know she'd been studying his unusual face. Lee regarded her with an expression she couldn't read. "My mother was white, and my father's mother. There are only 24 Chinese women in all of New York City, 36 at the absolute most." His face was very grave, and Mary knew that whether or not it was true, he believed it. Then, when she thought about it, she realized she couldn't remember ever seeing a Chinese woman. Not in the markets, not on the streets, not in the tenements, nowhere. "You are Irish, we know, and we hope that doesn't cause trouble for us. The Irish cause trouble for the Chinese more than any other. You being here is a favor, because Commissioner Ladarrell vouched for you." Mary didn't know what to say to that, so she didn't say anything. "How do you know him, by the way? Did you work for his family?" "No, I don't know him," Mary said quickly. "Yes, well," Lee said, and then told her to get to work. "He brings his shirts here from time to time." The work was as tedious as Mary remembered, with none of the magic that came with cooking. Where she needed only her knife and a pan of hot butter to turn a few ordinary ugly spuds into something wonderful, the laundry offered no real transformations. The 2 Lithuanian women remain hunchbacked over their tubs of water all day long, their bodies angled to get strength in their arms where there wasn't any left. They had red faces, and Mary supposed it was the physical effort of their work and from keeping their noses so close to the hot water and its broth of chemicals made to strip the clothes of odor, of any evidence of the bodies that had worn them. After 20 minutes of instruction on the box, Mary was made the mangle woman. Lee stood at the head of the contraption, a flat box about 3 feet long and 10 inches high, and showed her how to wrap bed linens or tablecloths around the pins below, and then how to push the wheel on top to make the box roll over these large, flat items that didn't need detailing or shape. Later, when she was done with the items that needed mangling, she could be boss of the irons, sanding and polishing the ones that had cooled. Amid all of this labor, this orchestra of pushing and pulling and wrestling with waterlogged fabrics, walked Chu, who gave Mary stern looks and clicked his tongue. On Mary's second day, she arrived at the laundry at the appointed time, but an hour into her work realized she'd been expecting something different that day, some slight deviation from the day before. By the 3rd and 4th days, she realized that there would never be any deviation. She arrived, hung her coat, pushed up her sleeves, began to work. At precisely the noon hour, she stopped to eat an apple and a wedge of cheese, while the Lithuanians sat across the table from her and made a picnic of black bread and dumplings stuffed with some kind of minced meat that Mary wanted to take apart with her fork and examine. They spoke in their own language and didn't bother with Mary at all. At half noon, she was back mangling, rolling the large flat board over florals and plaids, linens and thin cottons. In the afternoons, she marked time by the sudden surge of girls that spilled onto the sidewalk as the shift changed at the shirtwaist factory next door. The ones arriving called out greetings to one another as they hurried to the entrance. The ones leaving for the day stood in groups of 3 and 4 on the sidewalk outside the laundry and talked of their plans. Once in a while, one of them would hold out her hand for the others to admire a new engagement ring. Listening to them, Mary felt apart from everything around her, as if something had gotten hold of her and was warning her to stay quiet as she watched the hours and days of her life unfold, someone else playing the lead. "You'll take it," she heard her Aunt Kate say. "You'll take it like everyone else."
In the evenings, even though it was late and dark, and even though she didn't like walking to the boarding house at night because the block was almost abandoned, Mary roamed the city and tried to look forward to summer, when there would still be a little light left in the day once her work was over. She drew a large square in her mind and avoided every point between 25th and 38th streets, and between 2nd Avenue and Park, in case she would run into someone she knew. Not that it mattered, she reminded herself, with Alfred all the way downtown. After so many years together, even avoiding the place where they'd lived, reminders of him stood on other corners, other blocks. Between the two of them, they'd worked or walked every neighborhood. At night, in her narrow, single room, the light from the lamp not strong enough to read by, Mary lay on her back and remembered she was still young. She was working. She was luckier than most. She was not a woman who felt loneliness. She was not a woman who got weepy or complained. She was not, had never been, and wouldn't become one now. And then, as sometimes happened when the hour got late and there wasn't enough to occupy her, and she couldn't sleep, and her whole body felt full up with a question in need of an answer, though she couldn't think of exactly what that question might be, she thought of him, the other him, that baby, that boy, dead now for 11 years. She imagined Mr. Kirkenbauer remarried with other children, another wife, another new house. Did anyone ever visit that boy? He'd been thriving when she met him. He'd been growing and running and learning his words and accepting everything he was taught with joy. And then Mary had arrived for a job and he was dead within 5 weeks. That one, that baby, more than any of the ones on Dr. Soper's list, more than even her sister's twins, who seemed like little more than empty vessels from the very start, more than any of the ones they accused her of harming, Tobias Kirkenbauer bothered her most. If it was her fault, like they said it was, if she was to blame, if she was a walking, breathing germ, a death sentence, if it was her arrival that had killed him, her letting him eat off her spoon, her kissing him and squeezing him, if he really did die because of her, then she asked Jesus for mercy. She didn't mean to, she told God. She didn't know. Late at night, long after the other boarders were most likely asleep in their beds, she wondered about all those lab tests that came back positive, and all those lectures they gave to her about typhoid bacilli and hot soup versus cold salad, and what heating at high temperatures does to food, and where germs like to grow and thrive, and how, in all likelihood, it was her ice creams and puddings that were to blame. She thought back to the ship that brought her to America, and all those bodies that had been dropped into the gray ocean, a trail of heavy, sewn-up sacks she could follow back home if she ever chose to leave America one day. Anyway, it didn't matter anymore, Mary told herself in the morning as she rushed to rub a washcloth over her face. It didn't matter, she repeated as she struggled to pull on thick tights under her skirt and watched her own breath hover around her face as she grew more agitated. She knew, once again, that she hadn't killed that boy any more than she had killed any of the other people in that great, wide, filthy, throbbing city. It would be laughable, really, if it weren't already criminal for them to have locked her up. One woman, a cook, when every corner of America hid a pestilence just waiting to be stirred up, set free. After 6 weeks at the laundry, she'd made enough to rent a bed from a widow on the west side. She'd seen the ad in the paper, and instead of mailing her inquiry across town, she'd walked it over and pushed it through the mail slot of the building. Although the building was not grand, Mary acknowledged when she was back on the sidewalk looking at it that it was a perfectly decent one. And with just two women in the rooms, it wouldn't be much to keep it clean and everything in its place. The widow wrote to Mary with the date that she should come and the price of the bed. "It'll be like living with Aunt Kate," Mary decided as she gathered her few things from the boarding house. "It'll be something to get used to at first, but after a while it'll become routine, and she'll look forward to seeing me, and who knew? Mary might be there for the rest of the woman's life." She'd heard plenty of cases where a boarder becomes like one of the family, and she didn't see why it wasn't possible in her case as well. How difficult it must be, she thought, as she crossed the avenues and bent her head against the spring wind, to be an old woman in this city, to have to worry about gathering wood or coal, putting food on the table. She walked and walked and finally turned on 8th Avenue for the final stretch. "Yes," a woman answered Mary's knock, but a young woman, younger than Mary, with Mary's same style of hair and a nicer blouse. "I'm here about the bed. I wrote last week, and Mrs. Post wrote back to say I should come today." The
The woman sighed, throwing up her hands. Come in. She moved aside with a theatrical half-curtsy, and Mary stepped past her into the small kitchen. She admired the window over the sink and the little square of stained glass that someone had hung to catch the light. Then she turned slightly and noticed a cot. She'd slept in plenty of kitchens. Abutting the foot of that cot, she noticed another. Then, on the other side of the kitchen, another. "Oh, there's more," the woman promised, pointing to the next room. Mary peeked into a darkened bedroom and took in the larger bed, pushed up against the wall, the buffer of cots all around. There was nowhere to walk. The person, or people, who slept in the larger bed must have to crawl over the cots to get to the door. "But the ad," Mary said, wanting to argue the situation into the one she'd imagined and not the one that was. "Look, you want to stay? Great, I'm out of here next week. You want a regular shift or a night shift?" "Regular, day." "Well, that's working for you. The night shifts, we have two nurses here, are the real losers in this. They can't get a wink all day with the racket she makes. She needs us here, but she hates us here. You already left the other rooms you were in?" Both women looked down at Mary's small bag, and the other woman laughed. Mary's was one of the cots in the bedroom. She thought she'd gotten lucky when she saw that hers